The Adventures of Captain David Grief by Jack London. Prologue. How many millions David Grief was worth, no man in the Solomons knew, for his holdings and ventures were everywhere in the great South Pacific. From Samoa to New Guinea, and even to the north of the line, his plantations were scattered. He possessed pearling concessions in the Tuamotus. Though his name did not appear, he was in truth the German company that traded in the French Marquesas. His trading stations were in strings in all the groups, and his vessels that operated them were many. He owned atolls so remote and tiny that his smallest schooners and ketches visited the solitary agents but once a year. In Sydney, on Castlereagh Street, his offices occupied three floors, but he was rarely in those offices. He preferred always to be on the go among the islands, nosing out new investments, inspecting and shaking up old ones, and rubbing shoulders with fun and adventure in a thousand strange guises. He bought the wreck of the great steamship Gavon for a song, and in salvaging it achieved the impossible and cleaned up a quarter of a million. In the Louisiade he planted the first commercial rubber, and in Bora Bora he ripped out the South Sea cotton and put the islanders to working and planting cacao. It was he who took the deserted island of Laluka, colonised it with Polynesians from Ontong Java Atoll, and planted 4,000 acres of coconuts. And it was he who reconciled the warring chief stocks of Tahiti and swung the great deal of the phosphate island of Hikihu. His own vessels recruited his contract labour. They brought Santa Cruz natives to the New Hebrides natives to the Banks, and the head-hunting aborigines of Malaita to the plantations of New Georgia. From Tonga to the Gilberts, and on to the far Louisiade, his recruiters combed the islands for labour. His keels ploughed all ocean stretches. He owned three steamers on regular island runs, though he rarely elected to travel in them, preferring the wilder and more primitive way of wind and sail. At least 40 years of age, he looked no more than 30, yet beachcombers remembered his advent among the islands a score of years before. Unlike other white men in the tropics, he was there because he liked it. His protective skin pigmentation was excellent. He had been born to the sun. One he was in 10,000 in the matter of sun resistance. The invisible and high-velocity light waves failed to bore into him. Other white men were pervious. The sun drove through their skins, ripping and smashing tissues and nerves till they became sick in mind and body, tossed most of the Decalogue overboard, went to pieces, and drank themselves into quick graves or survived so savagely that war vessels were sometimes sent to curb their license. But David Grief was a true son of the sun, and he flourished in all its ways. He merely became browner with the passing of the years, though in the brown was the hint of golden tint that glows in the skin of the Polynesian. Yet his blue eyes retained their blue, and the lines of his face were those which had persisted through the centuries in his English race. English he was in blood, yet those that thought they knew contended he was at least American-born. Unlike them, he had not come out to the South Seas seeking hearth and saddle of his own. In fact, he had brought hearth and saddle with him. His advent had been in the Tuamotus. He arrived on board a tiny schooner yacht, master and owner, a youth questing romance and adventure along the sun-washed paths of the tropics. He also arrived in a hurricane, the giant waves of which deposited him and yacht and all in the thick of a coconut grove 300 yards beyond the surf. 6 months later, he was rescued by a pearling cutter, but the sun had got into his blood. At Tahiti, instead of taking a steamer home, he bought a schooner, outfitted her with trade goods and divers, and went for a cruise through the dangerous archipelago. As the golden tint burned into his face, it poured molten out of the ends of his fingers. His was the golden touch. But he played the game not for gold, but for the game's sake. It was a man's game. The rough contacts and fierce give-and-take of the adventurers of his own blood, and of half the bloods of Europe and the rest of the world. And it was a good game. But over and beyond was his love of all the other things that go to make up a South Seas rover's life. The smell of the reef, the infinite exquisiteness of the shoals of living coral in the mirror-surfaced lagoons, the crashing sunrises of raw colours spread with lawless cunning, the palm-tufted islets set in turquoise deeps, the tonic wine of the trade winds, the heave and send of the orderly crested seas, the moving deck beneath his feet, the straining canvas overhead, the flower-garlanded, golden-glowing men and maids of Polynesia, half-children and half-gods, and even the howling savages of Melanesia, headhunters and man-eaters.
File 2.
The Proud Goat of Aloysius Pankburn. Quick eye that he had for the promise of adventure, prepared always for the unexpected to leap out at him from behind the nearest coconut tree, nevertheless, David Grief received no warning when he laid eyes on Aloysius Pankburn. It was on the little steamer Bert. Leaving his schooner to follow, Grief had taken passage for the short run across from Raiatea to Papeete in Tahiti. When he first saw Aloysius Pankburn, that less-than-sober gentleman was drinking a lonely cocktail at the tiny bar between decks next to the barber shop. And when Grief left the barber's hands an hour later, Aloysius Pankburn was still hanging over the bar, drinking by himself. Now it is not good for a man to drink alone, and Grief threw sharp scrutiny into his passing glance. He saw a well-built young man of 30, well-featured, well-dressed, and evidently, in the world's catalogue, a gentleman. But in the faint hint of slovenliness, in the shaking, eager hand that spilled the liquor, and in the nervous, vacillating eyes, Grief read the unmistakable marks of the chronic alcoholic. After dinner, he chanced upon Pankburn again. This time it was on deck, and the young man was clinging to the rail and peering into the distance at the dim forms of a man and a woman in two steamer chairs drawn closely together. Grief noted that the man's arm was around the woman's waist. Aloysius Pankburn looked on and cried.
"Nothing to weep about," Grief said genially.
Pankburn looked at him and gushed tears of profound self-pity.
"It's hard," he sobbed. Hard. That man's my business manager. I employ him. I pay him a good wage. And that's how he earns it."
"Well, in any case, why don't you put a stop to it?" Grief advised.
"I can't. She'd shut off my whiskey. She's my trained nurse."
"Well, fire her, then, and drink her head off."
"I can't. He's got all my money. If I did, he wouldn't give me a nickel to buy a drink with."
This woeful possibility brought a fresh wash of tears. Grief was interested. Of all unique situations, he could never have imagined such a one as this.
"They were engaged to take care of me," Pankburn was blubbering, "to keep me away from liquor. And that's the way they do it, necking all over the ship and letting me drink myself to death. It isn't right, I tell you, it isn't right. They were sent along for the express purpose of not letting me drink, and they let me drink myself pie-eyed just as long as I leave them alone. If I complain, they threaten not to let me have another drop. What can a poor devil do? My death will be on their heads, that's all. Come on down and join me."
He released his clutch on the rail, and would have fallen had not Grief caught his arm. He seemed to undergo a transformation, to stiffen physically, to thrust his chin forward aggressively and to glint harshly in his eyes.
"Oh, I won't let them kill me. They'll be sorry. I've offered them 50,000. Later on, of course. They laughed. They don't know. But I know."
He fumbled in his coat pocket and drew forth an object that flashed in the faint light.
"They don't know the meaning of that. But I do."
He looked at Grief with abrupt suspicion.
"What do you make of it, eh? What do you make of it?"
David Grief caught a swift vision of an alcoholic degenerate putting a very loving young couple to death with a copper spike, for a copper spike was what he held in his hand, an old-fashioned ship's fastening.
"My mother thinks I'm out here to get cured of the booze habit. She doesn't know. I bribed the doctor to prescribe a voyage. When we get to Papeete, my manager is going to charter a schooner, and away we'll sail. But they don't dream. They think it's the booze. I know. I only know. Well, good night, sir. I'm going to bed. Unless you'll join me in a nightcap. One last drink, you know.
In the week that followed at Papeete, Grief caught numerous and bizarre glimpses of Aloysius Pankburn. So did everyone else in the little island capital, for neither the beach nor Lavina's boarding house had seen anything like it in years. At midday, bareheaded, clad in swimming trunks, Aloysius Pankburn ran down the main street from Lavina's to the waterfront. He put on the boxing gloves with a fireman from the steamer Belt in a scheduled four-round bout at the Folie Bergère, and was knocked out in the second round. He tried insanely to drown himself in a 2-foot pool of water, dived drunkenly and splendidly from 50 feet up in the rigging of the Mariposa lying at the wharf, and chartered the cutter Toe Rau at more than her purchase price, and was only saved by his manager's refusal financially to ratify the agreement. He bought out the old blind leper at the market, and sold breadfruit, plantains, and sweet potatoes at such cut rates that the gendarmes were called out to break the rush of bargain-hunting natives. For that matter, 3 times the gendarme arrested him for riotous behaviour, and 3 times his manager ceased from love-making long enough to pay the fines imposed by a needy colonial administration. Then the Mariposa sailed for San Francisco, and in the bridal suite, with a manager and the trained nurse, fresh married. Before departing, the manager had thoughtfully bestowed 8 $20 bills on Aloysius, with a foreseen result that Aloysius awoke several days later to find himself broke and perilously near delirium tremens. Lavina, famed for her good heart, even among the driftage of South Pacific rogues and scamps, nursed him around, and never let it filter into his returning intelligence that there was neither manager nor money to pay his board. It was several evenings after this that David Grief, lounging under the after-deck awning of the Kittiwake and idly scanning the meagre columns of the Papeete Avant-Coureur, sat suddenly up and almost rubbed his eyes. It was unbelievable. But there it was. The old South Seas romance was not dead. He read, "Wanted, to exchange a half interest in buried treasure worth $1,000,000 for transportation for one to an unknown island in the Pacific and facilities for carrying away the loot. Ask for Folly at Lavina's." Grief looked at his watch. It was early yet, only 8 o'clock. "Mr. Carlson," he called in the direction of a glowing pipe, "get the crew for the whaleboat. I'm going ashore." The husky voice of the Norwegian mate was raised forward, and half a dozen strapping Rapa Islanders ceased their singing and manned the boat. "I came to see Folly, Mr. Folly, I imagine," David Grief told Lavina. He noted the quick interest in her eyes as she turned her head and flung a command across 2 open rooms to the kitchen. A few minutes later, a barefoot native girl padded in and shook her head. Lavina's disappointment was evident.
"You're aboard the Kittiwake, aren't you?"
she said.
"I'll tell him you're called."
"Then it is a he?" Lavina nodded.
"I hope you can do something for him, Captain Grief. He's a likable man, and he may be telling the truth. I don't know. You'll know. You're not a soft-hearted fool like me. Can't I mix you a cocktail?"
Back on board his schooner, and dozing in a deck chair under a 3-month-old magazine, David Grief was aroused by a sobbing, slubbering noise from overside. He opened his eyes. From the Chilean cruiser, 1/4 mile away, came the stroke of 8 bells. It was midnight. From overside came a splash and another slubbering noise. To him it seemed half-amphibian, half the sound of a man crying to himself and querulously chanting his sorrows to the general universe. A jump took David Grief to the low rail. Beneath, centred about the slubbering noise, was an area of agitated phosphorescence. Leaning over, he locked his hand under the armpit of a man, and with pull and heave and quick-changing grips, he drew on deck the naked form of Aloysius Pankburn.
"I didn't have a penny,"
Pankburn complained.
"I had to swim it. I couldn't find your gangway. It was very miserable. Pardon me, if you have a towel to put about my middle and a good stiff drink, I'll be more myself. I'm Mr. Folly, and you're the Captain Grief, I presume, who called on me when I was out. No, I'm not drunk, nor am I cold. This isn't shivering. Lavina allowed me only two drinks today. I'm on the edge of the horrors, that's all, and I was beginning to see things when I couldn't find the gangway. If you'll take me below, I'll be very grateful. You were the only one that answered my advertisement."
He was shaking pitiably in the warm night, and down in the cabin, before he got his towel, Grief saw to it that a half-tumbler of whiskey was in his hand.
File 3.
"Now, fire away," Grief said, when he got his guest into a shirt and a pair of duck trousers. "What's this advertisement of yours? I'm listening." Pankburn looked at the whiskey bottle, but Grief shook his head.
"Oh, all right, Captain. Though I tell you on whatever is left of my honour that I am not drunk, not in the least. Also, what I shall tell you is true, and I shall tell it briefly, for it is clear to me that you are a man of affairs and action. Likewise, your chemistry is good. To you, alcohol has never been a million maggots gnawing at every cell of you. You've never been to hell. I am there now. I am scorching. Now listen. My mother is alive. She is English. I was born in Australia. I was educated at York and Yale. I'm a Master of Arts, a Doctor of Philosophy, and I'm no good. Furthermore, I am an alcoholic. I have been an athlete. I used to swan dive 110 feet in the clear. I hold several amateur records. I swim like a fish. I've done 30 miles in a rough sea. I have another record. I've punished more whiskey than any man of my years. I will steal a nickel from you for the price of a drink. Finally, I will tell you the $1 million story. My father was an American, and an Annapolis man, lieutenant on the Suwannee. Her captain was Paul Shirley. The Suwannee once coaled at an island in the Pacific, which I do not care to mention, now under a protectorate which did not exist then, and which shall be nameless. Ashore, behind the bar of a public house, my father saw three copper spikes. Ship spikes. David Grief smiled quietly. "And I can tell you the name of the coaling station, and of the protectorate that came afterward," he said.
"And of the three spikes?"
Pankburn asked with equal quietness.
"Go ahead, for they are now in my possession."
"Certainly. They were behind German Oscar's bar at Pinupini. Johnny Black brought them there from off his schooner the night he died. He was just back from a long cruise to the westward, fishing bêche de mer and sandalwood trading. All the beach knows the tale." Pankburn nodded his head. "Go on," he urged.
"Oh, it was before my time, of course," Grief explained. "I only tell what I've heard. Next came the Ecuadorian cruiser, in from the westward of all directions, and bound home. Her officers recognized the spikes. Johnny Black was dead. They got hold of his mate and logbook. Away to the westward she went. 6 months after, again bound home, she dropped in at Pinupini. She had failed, and the tale leaked out. When the revolutionists were marching on Guayaquil," Pankburn took it up, "the federal officers, believing a defence of the city hopeless, salted down the government treasure chest, something like $1 million gold, but all in English coinage, and put it on board the American schooner Flirt. They were going to run at daylight. The American captain skinned out in the middle of the night. Well, go on." "It's an old story," Grief resumed. There was no other vessel in the harbour. The federal leaders couldn't run. They put their backs to the wall and held the city.
Rojas Salced, making a forced march from Quito, raised the siege. The revolution was broken, and the one ancient steamer that constituted the Ecuadorian navy was sent in pursuit of the flirt. They caught her between the Banks group and the New Hebrides, hove to, and flying distress signals. The captain had died the day before. Blackwater fever.
And the mate?
Pankburn challenged. The mate had been killed a week earlier by the natives on one of the banks when they sent a boat in for water. There were no navigators left. The men were put to torture. It was beyond international law. They wanted to confess, but couldn't. They told of the three spikes in the trees on the beach. But where the island was, they did not know. To the westward, far to the westward, was all they knew. The tale now goes two ways. One is they all died under the torture. The other is that the survivors were swung at the yardarm. At any rate, the Ecuadorian cruiser went home without the treasure. Johnny Black had brought the three spikes to Pinupini and left them at German Oscar's. But how and where he found them, he never told. Pankburn looked hard at the whiskey bottle.
Oh, just two fingers, he whimpered.
Grief considered and poured a meagre drink. Pankburn's eyes sparkled, and he took a new lease on life.
And this is where I come in with the missing details, he said. Johnny Black did tell. He told my father, wrote him from Lavuka before he came on to die at Pinupini. My father had saved his life one roughhouse night in Valparaiso. A Chinese pearler out of Thursday Island, prospecting for new grounds to the north of New Guinea, traded for the three spikes somewhere with a native. Johnny Black bought them for the scrap value of the copper. He didn't dream any more than the Chinese that they meant anything special. But coming back, he stopped for Hawksbill Turtle at the very beach where you say the mate of the flirt was killed. Only he wasn't killed. The Banks Islanders held him prisoner, and he was dying of necrosis of the jawbone, caused by an arrow wound in a fight on the beach. Before he died, he told the whole story to Johnny Black. Johnny Black wrote my father from Lavuka. He was at the end of his rope. Cancer. My father got the spikes from German Oscar, and from my father, last will and testament, you know, came the spikes and the data. I have the island, the latitude and longitude of the beach where the three spikes were nailed in the trees. The spikes are up at Lavina's now. The latitude and longitude are in my head. Now, what do you think?
Fishy, was Grief's instant judgment. Why didn't your father go and get it himself?
Didn't need it. An uncle died and left him a fortune.
He retired from the Navy, ran afoul of an epidemic of trained nurses in Boston. My mother got a divorce. Also, she fell heir to an income of something like $30,000 and went to live in New Zealand. I was divided between them, half the time New Zealand, half the time United States, until my father's death last year. Now my mother has me altogether. He left me his money, a couple of millions, but my mother has had guardians appointed on account of the liquor. Oh, I'm worth all kinds of money. But I can't touch a penny, save what is doled out to me. But the old man, who had got the tip on my drinking, left me the three spikes and the data thereunto pertaining. Did it through his lawyers, unknown to my mother. Said it beat life insurance, and that if I had the backbone to go and get it, I could drink my back teeth awash until I died. Millions in the hands of my guardians, lots of my mother's dough that'll be mine if she beats me to the crematory, another million waiting to be dug up, and in the meantime I'm cadging on Lavina for two drinks a day. It's hell, isn't it, when you consider my thirst. Where's the island? A long way from here.
Name it.
Not on your life, Captain Grief. You're making an easy half million out of this. You will sail under my directions, and when we're well to sea and on our way, I'll tell you. Not before. Grief shrugged his shoulders, dismissing the subject. "When I've given you another drink, I'll send the boat ashore with you," he said. Pankburn was taken aback. For at least 5 minutes he debated with himself, then licked his lips and surrendered.
"If you promise to go, I'll tell you now.
Of course I'm willing to go. That's why I asked you. Name the island.
Pankburn looked at the bottle. I'll take that drink now, Captain.
No, you won't. That drink was for you if you went ashore. If you're going to tell me the island, you must do it sober. France's island, since you insist. Bougainville named it Barber Island.
Off all by its lonely in the little coral sea, Grief said.
I know it. Lies between New Ireland and New Guinea. Rotten hole now. Although it was all right when the Flirt drove in the spikes and the Chinese Perler traded for them. The steamship Castor, recruiting labour for the Samoan plantations, was cut off there with all hands 2 years ago. I knew her captain well. The Germans sent a cruiser, shelled a bush, burned half a dozen villages, killed a couple of natives and a lot of pigs, and that was all. The natives always were mad there, but they turned really mad 40 years ago. That was when they cut off a whaler.
Now let me see, what was her name? He stepped to the bookshelf, drew out the bulky South Pacific directory, and ran through its pages.
Yes, here it is. Francis, or Barber, he skimmed. Natives, warlike, Melanesian, whale ship Western cut off. That was her name. Shoals, points, anchorages. Red Scar. Owen Bay, Leaky Killy Bay. Yeah, that's more like it. Deep indentation, mangrove swamps, good holding in 9 fathoms when white scar in bluff bears west-southwest. Grief looked up. That's your beach, Pankburn, I'll swear.
Will he go? The other demanded eagerly. Grief nodded.
Sounds good to me. Now, if the story had been of 100 million or some such crazy sum, I wouldn't look at it for a moment. We'll sail tomorrow. But under one consideration, you are to be absolutely under my orders.
His visitor nodded emphatically and joyously.
And that means no drink.
Oh, that's pretty hard, Pankburn whined.
It's my terms. I'm enough of a doctor to see you don't come to harm. And you are to work. Hard work. Sailor's work. You'll stand regular watches and everything, though you eat and sleep aft with us.
It's a deal. Pankburn put out his hand to ratify the agreement.
If it doesn't kill me, he added.
David Grief poured a generous 3 fingers into the tumbler and extended it.
Then there's your last drink. Take it.
Pankburn's hand went halfway out. With a sudden spasm of resolution, he hesitated, threw back his shoulders, and straightened up his head.
I guess I won't, he began. Then, feebly surrendering to the gnaw of desire, he reached hastily for the glass, as if in fear that it would be withdrawn.
File 4.
It is a long traverse from Papeete in Tahiti to the Little Coral Sea, from 150 west longitude to 150 east longitude, as the crow flies, equivalent to a voyage across the Atlantic. But the Kittiwake did not go as the crow flies. David Grief's numerous interests diverted her course many times. He stopped to have a look in at uninhabited Rose Island, with an eye to colonizing and planting coconuts. Next, he paid his respects to Tui Manua of Eastern Samoa, and opened an intrigue for a share of the trade monopoly of that dying king's 3 islands. From Apia, he carried several relief agents and a load of trade goods to the Gilberts. He peeped in at Ontong Java Atoll, inspected his plantations on Santa Isabel, and purchased lands from the saltwater chiefs of northwestern Malaita. And all along this devious way he made a man of Aloysius Pankburn. That thirster, though he lived aft, was compelled to do the work of a common sailor. And not only did he take his wheel and lookout, and heave to on sheets and tackles, but the dirtiest and most arduous tasks were appointed him. Swung aloft in a boatswain's chair, he scraped the masts and slushed down. Holystoning the deck, or scrubbing it with fresh limes, made his back ache and developed the wasted, flabby muscles. When the Kittiwake lay at anchor
and her copper bottom was scrubbed with coconut husks by the native crew, who dived and did it underwater, Pankburn was sent down on his shift, and as many times as any on the shift.
"Look at yourself," Grief said. "You're twice the man you were when you came on board. You haven't had one drink, you didn't die, and the poison is pretty well worked out of you. It's the work. Beats trained nurses and business managers. Here, if you're thirsty, clap your lips to this."
With several deft strokes of his heavy-backed sheath-knife, Grief clipped a triangular piece of shell from the end of a husked drinking coconut. The thin, cool liquid, slightly milky and effervescent, bubbled to the brim. With a bow, Pankburn took the natural cup, threw his head back, and held it back till the shell was empty. He drank many of these nuts each day. The steward, a New Hebrides native, 60 years of age, and his assistant, a Lark Islander of 11, saw to it that he was continually supplied. Pankburn did not object to the hard work. He devoured work, never shirking and always beating the native sailors in jumping to obey a command. But his sufferings during the period of driving the alcohol out of his system were truly heroic. Even when the last shred of the poison was exuded, the desire, as an obsession, remained in his head. So it was when, on his honour, he went ashore at Apia in Samoa, that he attempted to put the bars out of business by drinking up their stock in trade. And so it was, at 2 in the morning, that David Grief found him in front of the Tivoli, out of which he had been thrown by Charlie Roberts. Aloysius, as of old, was chanting his sorrows to the stars. Also, and more concretely, he was punctuating the rhythm with cobbles of coral stone, which he flung with amazing accuracy through Charlie Roberts' windows. David Grief took him away, but not till next morning did he take him in hand. It was on the deck of the Kittiwake, and there was nothing kindergarten about it. Grief struck him with bare knuckles, punched him and punished him, gave him the worst thrashing he had ever received.
"For the good of your soul, Pankburn," was the way he emphasized his blows. "For the good of your mother, for the good of the progeny that will come after, for the good of the world and the universe and the whole race of man yet to be. And now, to hammer the lesson home, we'll do it all over again. That for the good of your soul, and that for your mother's sake, and that for the little children undreamed of and unborn, whose mother you'll love for their sakes and for love's sake, in the lease of manhood that will be yours when I am done with you. Ah, come on and take your medicine. I'm not done with you yet. Oh, I've only begun. There are many other reasons which I shall now proceed to explain to you."
The sailors and the stewards and cook looked on and grinned. As for Carlson, the mate, he was grimly in accord with the treatment his employer was administering, while Albright, the supercargo, merely played with his moustache and smiled. They were men of the sea. They lived life in the rough. And alcohol, in themselves as well as in other men, was a problem they had learned to handle in ways not taught in the doctor's schools.
"Steward, a bucket of fresh water and a towel," Grief ordered when he had finished. "Two buckets and two towels," he added, as he surveyed his own hands. "You're a pretty one," he said to Pankburn. "You've spoiled everything. I have the poison completely out of you, and now you are fairly reeking with it. We've got to begin all over again. Mr. Albright, you know that pile of old chain on the beach at the boat landing? Find the owner, buy it, and fetch it on board. There must be 150 fathoms of it. Pankburn, tomorrow morning you start pounding the rust off it. When you've done that, you'll sandpaper it. Then you'll paint it. And nothing else will do till that chain is as smooth as new."
Aloysius Pankburn shook his head.
"I quit. Francis Island can go to hell for all of me. I'm done with your slave driving. Kindly put me ashore at once. You can't treat me this way. Mr. Carlson, you will see that Mr. Pankburn remains on board." "I'll fix you for this," Aloysius screamed. "You can't keep me here."
"I can give you another licking," Grief answered. "And let me tell you one thing, you besotted whelp. I'll keep on licking you as long as my knuckles hold out, or until you yearn to hammer chain rust. I've taken you in hand, and I'm going to make a man out of you if I have to kill you to do it. Now go below and change your clothes. Be ready to turn to with a hammer this afternoon. Mr. Albright, get that chain aboard pronto. Mr. Carlson, send the boats ashore after it. Also, keep your eye on Pankburn. If he shows signs of keeling over or going into the shakes, give him a small nip of whiskey. A small one. He may need it after last night. For the rest of the time, the Kittiwake lay in Apia. Aloysius Pankburn pounded chain rust. 10 hours a day he pounded. And on the long stretch across to the Gilberts, he still pounded. Then came the sandpapering. 150 fathoms is 900 feet, and every link of all that length was smoothed and polished as no link ever was before. And when the last link had received its second coat of black paint, he declared himself.
"Come on with more dirty work," he told Grief. "I'll overhaul the other chains if you say so, and you needn't worry about me any more. I'm not going to take another drop. I'm going to train up. You got my goat when you beat me, but let me tell you, you only got it temporarily. Train? I'm going to train until I'm as hard all the way through and as clean all the way through as that chain is. And some day, Mr. David Grief, somewhere, somehow, I'm going to be in such shape that I'll lick you as you licked me. I'm going to pulp your face till your own sailors won't know you."
Grief was jubilant.
"Now you're talking like a man," he cried. "The only way you'll ever lick me is to become a man. And then, maybe..."
He paused in the hope that the other would catch the suggestion. Aloysius groped for it, and, abruptly, something akin to illumination shone in his eyes.
"And then I won't want to, you mean?"
Grief nodded.
"And that's the curse of it," Aloysius lamented. "I really believe I won't want to. I see the point, but I'm going to go right on and shape myself up just the same."
The warm, sunburned glow in Grief's face seemed to grow warmer. His hand went out.
"Pankburn, I love you right now for that."
Aloysius grasped the hand and shook his head in sad sincerity.
"Grief," he mourned, "you've got my goat. You've got my proud goat, and you've got it permanently, I'm afraid."
File 5.
On a sultry tropic day, when the last flicker of the far southeast trade was fading out, and the seasonal change for the northwest monsoon was coming on, the Kittiwake lifted above the sea rim the jungle-clad coast of France's island. Grief, with compass bearings and binoculars, identified the volcano that marked Red Scar, ran past Owen Bay, and lost the last of the breeze at the entrance to Likikili Bay. With the two whaleboats out and towing, and with Carlson heaving the lead, the Kittiwake sluggishly entered a deep and narrow indentation. There were no beaches. The mangroves began at the water's edge, and behind them rose steep jungle, broken here and there by jagged peaks of rock. At the end of a mile, when the white scar on the bluff bore west-southwest, the lead vindicated the directory, and the anchor rumbled down in 9 fathoms. For the rest of that day, and until the afternoon of the day following, they remained on the Kittiwake and waited. No canoes appeared. There were no signs of human life. Save for the occasional splash of a fish or the screaming of cockatoos, there seemed no other life. Once, however, a huge butterfly, 12 inches from tip to tip, fluttered high over their mastheads and drifted across to the opposing jungle.
"There's no use sending a boat in to be cut up," Grief said.
Pankburn was incredulous and volunteered to go in alone, to swim it if he couldn't borrow the dinghy.
"They haven't forgotten the German cruiser," Grief explained. "I'll wager that bush is alive with men right now." "What do you think, Mr. Carlson?"
That veteran adventurer of the islands was emphatic in his agreement. In the late afternoon of the second day, Grief ordered a whaleboat into the water. He took his place in the bow, a cigarette in his mouth, and a short-fused stick of dynamite in his hand, for he was bent on shooting a mess of fish. Along the thwarts, 6 Winchester rifles were placed. Albright, who took the steering sweep, had a Mauser within reach.
They pulled in along the green wall of vegetation. At times, they rested on the oars in the midst of a profound silence.
2-1, the bush is swarming with them on a 5-spot, Albright whispered.
Pankburn listened a moment longer and took the bet. 5 minutes later, they sighted a school of mullet. The rowers held their oars. Grief touched the short fuse to his cigarette and threw the stick. So short was the fuse that the stick exploded the instant after it struck the water. And in that same instant, the bush exploded into life. There were wild yells of defiance, and naked bodies leapt forward through the mangroves. In the whaleboat, every rifle was lifted. Then came the wait. 100 Aborigines, some few armed with ancient Sniders, but the greater proportion armed with tomahawks, fire-hardened spears, and bone-tipped arrows, clustered on the roots that rose out of the bay. No word was spoken. Each party watched the other across 20 feet of water. An old, one-eyed chief with a bristly face rested a Snider on his hip, the muzzle directed at Albright, who, in turn, covered him back with the Mauser. A couple of minutes of this tableau endured. The stricken fish rose to the surface, or struggled half-stunned in the clear depths.
"It's all right, boys," Grief said quietly. "Put down your guns and over the side with you. Mr. Albright, toss the tobacco to that one-eyed gentleman."
While the Rapa men dived for the fish, Albright threw a bundle of trade tobacco ashore. The one-eyed man nodded his head and writhed his features in an attempt at amiability. Weapons were lowered, bows unbent, and arrows put back into quivers.
"They know tobacco," Grief announced as they rowed back aboard. "We'll have visitors. You break out a case of tobacco, Mr. Albright, and a few trade knives. Yeah, there's a canoe now."
Old One-Eye, as befitted a chief and leader, paddled out alone, facing peril for the rest of his tribe. As Carlson leaned over the rail to help the visitor up, he turned his head and remarked casually,
"They've dug up the money, Mr. Grief. The old man's loaded with it."
One-Eye floundered down on deck, grinning appeasingly and failing to hide the fear he had overcome, but which still possessed him. He was lame of one leg, and this was accounted for by a terrible scar, inches deep, which ran down the thigh from hip to knee. No clothes he wore whatever, not even a string, but his nose, perforated in a dozen places, and each perforation the setting for a carved spine of bone, bristled like a porcupine. Around his neck, and hanging down on his chest, was a string of gold sovereigns. His ears were hung with silver half-crowns, and from the cartilage separating his nostrils depended a big English penny, tarnished and green, but unmistakable.
"Hold on, Grief," Pankburn said, with perfectly assumed carelessness. "You say they only know beads and tobacco. Very well, you follow my lead. They found the treasure, and we've got to trade them out of it. Get the whole crew aside and lecture them that they are to be interested only in pennies. Savvy? Gold coins must be beneath contempt, and silver coins merely tolerated. Pennies are to be the only desirable things."
Pankburn took charge of the trading. For the penny in the one-eyed chief's nose, he gave 10 sticks of tobacco. Since each stick cost David Grief a cent, the bargain was manifestly unfair. But for the half-crowns, Pankburn gave only 1 stick each. The string of sovereigns he refused to consider. The more he refused, the more One-Eye insisted on a trade. At last, with an appearance of irritation and anger, and as a palpable concession, Pankburn gave 2 sticks for the string, which was composed of 10 sovereigns.
"I take my hat off to you," Grief said to Pankburn that night at dinner. "You've reversed the scale of value. They'll figure the pennies as priceless possessions and the sovereigns as beneath price. Result, they'll hang on to the pennies and force us to trade for sovereigns. Pankburn, I drink your health. Steward, another cup of tea for Mr. Pankburn."
There followed a golden week. From dawn till dark, a row of canoes rested on their paddles 200 feet away. This was the deadline.
Rapa sailors, armed with rifles, maintained it. Only one canoe at a time was permitted alongside, and only one native at a time was permitted to come over the rail. Here, under the awning, relieving one another in hourly shifts, the four white men carried on the trade. The rate of exchange was that established by Pankburn with One Eye. 5 sovereigns fetched a stick of tobacco. 100 sovereigns, 20 sticks. Thus, an Aborigine would deposit on the table $1,000 in gold and go back over the rail, hugely satisfied, with 40 cents worth of tobacco in his hand.
"Hope you got enough tobacco to hold out,"
Carlson muttered dubiously as another case was sawn in half. Albright laughed.
"We got 50 cases below," he said, "and as I figure it, 3 cases buy $100,000. There was only $1 million buried, so 30 cases ought to get it. Though, of course, we've got to allow a margin for the silver and the pennies. That Ecuadorian bunch must have salted down all the coin in sight."
Very few pennies and shillings appeared, though Pankburn continually and anxiously inquired for them. Pennies were the one thing he seemed to desire, and he made his eyes flash covetously whenever one was produced. True to his theory, the natives concluded that the gold, being of slight value, must be disposed of first. A penny, worth 50 times as much as a sovereign, was something to retain and treasure. Doubtless in their jungle lairs, the wise old greybeards put their heads together and agreed to raise the price on pennies when the worthless gold was all worked off. Who could tell? Mayhap the strange white men could be made to give even 20 sticks for a priceless copper. By the end of the week, the trade went slack. There was only the slightest dribble of gold. An occasional penny was reluctantly disposed of for 10 sticks, while several $1,000 in silver came in. On the morning of the 8th day, no trading was done. The greybeards had matured their plan and were demanding 20 sticks for a penny. The one-eyed chief delivered the new rate of exchange. The white men appeared to take it with great seriousness, for they stood together debating in low voices. Had One Eye understood English, he would have been enlightened.
"We've got just a little over 800,000, not counting the silver," Grief said. "And that's about all there is. The bush tribes behind have most probably got the other 200,000. Return in 3 months, and the saltwater crowd will have traded back for it. Also, they'll be out of tobacco by that time."
"Yeah, it would be a sin to buy pennies," Albright grinned. "Goes against the 50 grain of my trader's soul."
"There's a whiff of land breeze stirring," Grief said, looking at Pankburn. "What do you say?"
Pankburn nodded.
"Very well."
Grief measured the faintness and irregularity of the wind against his cheek.
"Mr. Carlson, heave short and get off the gaskets, and stand by with the whaleboats to tow. This breeze is not dependable."
He picked up a part case of tobacco, containing 600 or 700 sticks, put it in One Eye's hands, and helped that bewildered native over the rail. As the foresail went up the mast, a wail of consternation arose from the canoes lying along the deadline, and as the anchor broke out and the Kittiwake's head paid off in the light breeze, old One Eye, daring the rifles levelled on him, paddled alongside and made frantic signs of his tribe's willingness to trade pennies for 10 sticks.
"Steward, a drinking nut!"
Pankburn called.
"It's Sydney Heads for you," Grief said. "And then what?" "Oh, I'm coming back with you for that 200,000, Pankburn answered. "In the meantime, I'm going to build an island schooner. Also, I'm going to haul those guardians of mine into court and show cause why my father's money should not be turned over to me." "Show cause? I'll show them cause why it should."
He swelled his biceps proudly under the thin sleeve.
"Come on, swing out on that foreboom tackle!"
Carlson shouted from aft, where the mainsail was being winged out. Pankburn dropped his coconut and raced for it, beating a Rapa sailor by 2 jumps to the hauling part. The end.